Hey folks, before we get right into the episode, I thought I should explain that this episode was actually recorded quite a bit ago, but due to some audio issues, I never released it. But since we're kind of in this lull of not being able to put out episodes for various scheduling reasons, I decided that I would get over myself and release it, even though there are a lot of audio glitches due to the microphone I was using during the recording. If you are as much an audio freak as I am, you might be a little annoyed like I was, but listening back, it's not quite as bad as I thought it was when I recalled it. But anyway, this is our episode on the imposter. I hope you enjoy it. Welcome back to The Real House with Deej and Trav, where legitimate film criticism goes to die. My name is Travis Whelan, and I'm joined, as always, by my idiot brother, DJ Whelan. How are you, DJ?
Well, you're listening to the smooth sounds of a special birthday edition here on The Real House. Happy birthday to my brother, my captain, my king.
Thank you, DJ. It will be my birthday in a few hours, so that's cool. As usual, we have a full-length review for this week. That is going to be on the new film, The Imposter. But before we do that, we're going to run through the usual segment, starting with the Minority Report, where we talk about the media we've been consuming recently. After that, we segue into the Mr. Holland's Opuses segment, where we talk specifically about the music we've been listening to recently. The break, intro, and outro music for the show is going to be coming from the music we review in the Opus section. section. Those albums are Metz by Metz and Souls at Zero by Neurosis. But DJ, where is your Minority Report, and do you even have one?
Yes, I do. I recently started watching the Showtime original series Homeland after hearing from critics, podcasters, coworkers, friends, and basically everyone that this show was awesome. Homeland tells the story of CIA counterterrorism operative Carrie Matheson, who's played by Claire Danes. She happens upon some intelligence that an American prisoner of war has defected to Al-Qaeda, and when special forces liberate a captive Marine sergeant from a bunker in Iraq shortly thereafter, this agent Carrie becomes convinced that he's the sleeper agent and basically has to blur the lines of what's acceptable CIA conduct in order to obtain the proof that she needs to accuse this guy before he can launch some kind of attack on U.S. soil, because this whole thing is set in this kind of post-9/11 world. Now, Homeland comes to us from the producers of the popular Fox TV show 24, and you can definitely feel that with all the counterterrorism and espionage and interrogation stuff. But instead of ending every episode with a shootout like 24 does, Homeland's idea of a climax is just to force all of its characters into nervous breakdowns. And that's what makes the show really gripping. The character of Carrie is presented as essentially a bipolar psychotic, and Damian Lewis plays the potentially seditious Sergeant Brody with exactly the kind of deranged ferocity you would expect in someone who's been tortured by Al-Qaeda for 8 years, as the show explains. So what you end up with is a lot of people getting hysterical and shouting and swearing at each other in really tense situations, and of course I love it. Subplots, there are subplots, and as always, some of them suck. Sergeant Brody's wife is played by the consistently terrible Marina Baccarin, who you'll remember from that nigh unwatchable remake of that TV show V on ABC last year. And of course, in the plot of Homeland, she started a relationship with Brody's best friend while he was missing and assumed dead. So that all feels really stale, and the show really drags its feet getting through all of that. But that is probably the one place where the show does drag, because in all other aspects, Homeland rushes forward at a reckless pace that I find really entertaining. Having heard the general description of the show I've just given, you've probably made some predictions about where the plot will eventually go, and it does go there, but much more quickly than any other show would dare to try. The writers accomplished this through frequent reliance on huge narrative leaps and contrivances that would normally drive me pretty bonkers, but I think it all works here because these cheats and tricks kind of reveal that the show's true priorities lie elsewhere. The counterterrorism and espionage is all just kind of this sandbox that's used to explore the problem of mental illness. So one character is plagued by a disorder that she was born with, and the other character's disorder is induced by his circumstances, his environment. It's a really effective treatise on that subject of like nature versus nurture, and Claire Danes' performance is so great that you can't help but be taken in by the story, and that's saying something, since as far as I can tell, she basically fell off the planet after she had that big break in Romeo and Juliet back in the 90s. Like in 2003, IMDb says she played a character named Girl at Seminar in some movie called The Rage in Placid Lake, which I've never heard of. So to go from that to this is really quite impressive. I think she's actually won an Emmy for her performance during the first season. I'm only halfway through that first season, and I'm really digging it. And I've heard that season two is even crazier than this one, so I'll certainly be sticking with this one, and it's definitely a recommendation. And as a side note, one of the things I really liked, one episode features these CIA operatives trying to interrogate and intimidate a hostage by blaring a grindcore song over this PA system, and I just found the idea hilarious that they torture someone with music that I choose to listen to on an almost daily basis. So that was funny. But yeah, I'm totally digging Homeland. It's every bit as crazy as insane as people have said, so I'm loving it. Trav, have you heard of this one at all?
Yeah, I haven't gotten to check it out yet, but I guess I'm wondering the sort of blistering pace that the plot progresses, does that ever hinder any possible character moments, or is it able to find those too, or is that really not even a priority? Like, does that not even really end up mattering because the plot is just so engrossing?
Yeah, the character moments move at the same pace that the plot does, so it's not like they're getting left behind, but they're every bit as accelerated as the story itself. So you kind of get characters interacting with each other in ways that you may have predicted, but not predicted to have happened so quickly. So it's kind of unsettling on all different fronts. The characters coming together, breaking apart, having conflicts, all while the story is kind of wildly unraveling. So it's kind of just this huge storm of craziness that's totally awesome.
Oh, that sounds cool. I'll definitely have to check that one out.
So, Trav, can I ask you at this point, where is your Minority Report, and do you even have one?
I do have one this week. The documentary Indie Game the Movie is on Netflix. I think it was recently added, because it seems like if I had noticed it before, I would have just watched it. This film came out this year, was shot in 2011, and it follows three developers of independent video games. The first being Team Meat, who made Super Meat Boy. It's two guys who made Super Meat Boy. Phil Fish, who made Fez, and Jonathan Blow, who made Braid. Each of those three development teams, or just one person in the case of the latter two, are at a different stage of development when the movie is being filmed. So you have Jonathan Blow, who has already released Braid, and it's already been a huge success, and you see sort of his reaction to the critical and commercial success of his game. Then you have Team Meat, who's kind of in crunch time. Their game is supposed to come out very, very soon, and they're panicking. And then you have Phil Fish, whose game Fez was announced way back in 2007, was supposed to come out in 2010, but was delayed over and over again, and to the point where people just assumed it wasn't going to happen. And so he has to go to PAX, which is a gaming convention, and present his game and prove to people that it still exists. So it's interesting to follow all these people in their different spots in the development, because you see sort of the success story of Jonathan Blow, and you're hoping that the same thing happens to the other two as you're watching. What I really liked about the movie is it presents these indie game developers as like the modern version of that reclusive artist archetype. All of these people are really unstable. For example, one of the two guys of Team Meat, Tommy, there's a part where he talks about how in making Super Meat Boy, which he as well as his partner Ed talk about as being sort of a reflection of themselves, like this is their childhood that they're making. He talks about how in order to do that, he's sacrificing social interaction. He never goes out. He, even if he wanted to go on a date or something, he wouldn't be able to pay for the other person's meal. He, whenever you see him going out and eating, he's always at Waffle House.
Oh,
so
no.
That gives you an idea of his state. And then you have Jonathan Blow, who, he's released his game and it's a huge success. It became the most financially successful independent game of all time. But he talks about how, even though it was even critically well received, he was depressed after releasing the game because he felt like people weren't liking it for the right reasons. And then you have Phil Fish, who, when he's asked by the interviewer if what's motivating him to finish Fez, he says that if he didn't finish Fez, he would kill himself.
Oh my.
And when he says it, it doesn't sound like a joke. It seems like he definitely would if he didn't. Luckily, we know that he has, because we're living in 2012 where Fez was released and sold like over 100,000 copies or something, so Phil Fish is doing A-okay. But it's interesting to see these people presented in that same sort of way that we think of that sort of depressive artist, because a lot of times when a media is trying to convince you that video games are art, they do just that. They try to convince you that video games are art and that these people are artists, and they spend so much time on that. But what I like about Indie Game the Movie is that it goes in basically already assuming that video games are art. And it says, hey, there are these artists doing these things. It's finally the step I've been wanting, where instead of that sort of self-reflexive trying to prove itself, it just presents the story of these people. The film does this really cool thing to get out of the sort of boring visuals of just watching people type on computers. Instead of just showing that, while people are being interviewed, the B-roll will often be, the cutaways, the stuff it cuts to, won't be them working on the game necessarily. It'll just be an abandoned amusement park or a guy on the beach using a metal detector. Just random sort of, almost disconnected stuff that's only emotionally relevant to what's being said. And that's a really ballsy move. And tonally, it really works, and some of those shots are beautiful. The music is composed by Jim Guthrie, who you might remember as doing the soundtrack for Sword and Sorcery, which is another independent game, and I love that soundtrack so much that I talked about it on this show as my opus, and his work here in Indie Game the Movie is just as good. There are some parts in the movie where it gets really, really touching. There's a sequence where Ed McMillan from Team Meat talks about how, his whole goal is to influence some kid out there as much as video games influenced him when he was a kid, and there's some really cool moments like that that make this, I think, accessible to someone who might not even be familiar with these specific games or even the concept of independent gaming. It when I was watching it, I thought a lot about the other documentary I like, Helvetica. When I said that, like, I only like two documentaries. It reminded me of another documentary I enjoy, Helvetica, which was about fonts, which before seeing that movie wasn't something I was that interested in, but afterwards completely, I am completely obsessed with, and I love that movie. I have played, or at least I haven't played Fez, but I've seen it played. I've played all three of these games before seeing the movie, but I imagine someone who hasn't would have a similar experience that I had watching Helvetica, watching this, that they might become interested in these things. The only downside is that sometimes I feel like the film is overly positive about these developers. Anytime a negative response is shown from like internet comments or something, it's represented as like a malicious attack. But I mean, some of these people are weirdos, so it feels a little not necessarily genuine when we're only getting their perspective on this story. But that's just a nitpick, because this movie is pretty awesome. DJ, have you seen Indie Game the movie? Have you heard of it?
I've not seen it, but I have heard of it. And I guess my question would be, as I'm sure we'll discuss when we get into our main review, documentarians are always going to present themselves right as being totally objective, like just presenting the story as it is. But as we all know, that's not always the case. Does this movie have some kind of like any little bit of an agenda to it that, or any kind of slant or bias that it's trying to get across?
Well, I mean, yeah, it's going to say that indie games are amazing and magical and stuff like that, which some of them definitely are. So, but yeah, like I said, it does sort of try to bring you into this world that you might not necessarily know, and it's desperately trying to convince you of how great some of these games are, and some of them really are. So
Does it speak to like the recent viral nature of indie gaming, where Angry Birds has suddenly like exploded, and I feel like I'm the only person on the planet that's not played Angry Birds before?
They don't specifically talk about Angry Birds, or actually I don't think they talk really about any mobile games like that, but they talk about how with digital distribution, this archetype or this mode of game development has just kind of appeared out of nowhere, that with games like Limbo and Minecraft, and they kind of have carved out a path for this new paradigm of game development, and how they sort of spread by word of mouth and reviews and things. So yeah, they do touch on it a little bit, especially in the beginning parts of the film. But without further ado, I think it's about time that we take a break, and when we come back, we are going to do our Mr. Holland's Opuses segment, where we talk about the music we've been listening to. So here's a clip from one of those records.
Welcome back to The Real House, the elephant graveyard of film criticism. I am DJ Wheeler, and I am joined, as always, by my brother, my captain, and my king, Travis Wheeler. Right now we're about to move into what we call our Mr. Holland's Opuses segment of the show, where we discuss and describe some of the records we've been listening to lately, in hopes that we can recommend them to our listeners. So Trav, to that end, can I ask you once again, what new opuses has Mr. Holland composed for you this week?
Yeah, I picked up the self-titled album by Metz. That's M-E-T-Z. Mats is a noise punk band, and so that's going to mean that they have all of the that sort of angry energy with punk and all the style that comes with, and all the musical styles that come with that, but with heavier distortion and more, just a more abrasive feel altogether. Some stuff that is on the edge of what you might call music sometimes, and some of the more tense sections. The sound of Mets relies on a really visceral guitar riffs, which, along with half shouted strident vocals, propel the music into this really fascinatingly uneasy space. This is not music that's going to calm you down. It's accompanied by really nice work on the drums, especially on some of the earlier tracks. It's quite impressive. But at its best, Mets creates this weird trance-like but still constantly nervous vibe that would probably be near impossible to replicate. The final track, Negative Space, seems straight out of the mind of like a paranoid schizophrenic. The beginning of the song has this this sort of repetitive lick that's really really cool. Like, it's a cool hook, but it keeps building and building. And then when the song ends, there's like 30 seconds of silence, making you think that the album's over and like your iPod just stopped playing it. But then, sort of out of the silence, there's this loud, like, electronic hum that keeps getting louder and louder until it dies down again. And it's like, that's a good encapsulation of a lot of the feel that this album is going for, because it's not going to want to make you happy. It's going to want to make you like nervously, intensely interested in what's going on. And the majority of the album is really strong, but some of the middle tracks, specifically one called Knife in the Water, which lacks the powerfully unsettling hooks in the rest of the album. And another one, the eighth track called Wasted, they just kind of scream wasted a lot. It ends up feeling a little more contrived than propulsive, like the other ones tend to. Those tracks in the middle fall a little flat, but because if you're listening to the whole thing through, it's those first and the last ones that you're going to remember anyway. And so the overall general impression of the album is very good, even if some of those middle tracks are a little lackluster. So I would give a recommendation to this Mets album if you enjoy the clips I'm going to use. There's, it's not like these clips are going to be non-representative of what you hear. A lot of it's going to sound very similar to the clips I'll choose. DJ, have you heard of this album or the band in general?
Yeah, I've heard a couple of the tracks, and I really enjoyed what I heard. It's kind of right up my alley, so it's been on my list to pick this one up. I would defy a punk band to at least at some point release a record that does not use the word wasted in some way. Sure. It shows up on like every album. But kind of the way I classify punk records is like in one of two bins, right? So one bin is like lyrical punk, where the musicians are maybe more focused on like the anti-establishment themes of their lyrics as opposed to the music itself. And then there's, you know, the musical punk, where it's about eschewing the traditions of classic rock and moving more towards like a raw do-it-yourself sound. So which of those two bins does it kind of fall into, or is it one of both?
Definitely the latter camp. I like the adjective you used to describe it, that raw sound. That's definitely what you have on display here, especially with the guitar parts, as they're definitely the lead here. The the vocals are almost only for they almost feel secondary. It's pretty much the guitar that's going to be the main melodic voice here, if you can call some of this a melody. So yeah, it's definitely in that latter camp, which is probably the stuff I end up enjoying the most, because the focus on the music allows for some more interesting things to be done there, which is definitely the case with this album by Metz. But DJ, I'm wondering, what has Mr. Holland composed for you this week?
Yeah, my journey through the back catalog of undisputed classics continues this week with the 1992 album Souls at Zero.
That's when I was born. So go ahead.
How fitting on your birthday edition. Yeah. But this album comes from California's post-metal stalwarts, Neurosis. So fans of crust, sludge, and doom metal often point to Souls at Zero as this turning point in extreme music, since it basically contains within it the blueprints for all the darker corners of metal and hardcore. Trev, you've discussed in previous episodes that one of the most challenging risks that musicians can take is to try and invoke fear within the listener, to be scary, essentially, and Neurosis are all about that. Souls at Zero cultivates this atmosphere of foreboding by opening each track with distorted audio clips and samples before launching into the songs proper, which reinforce the unsettling effect through heavy distortion and desperately howled vocals. One of their little tricks is to take arpeggiated guitar riffs, layer them on top of each other, and then play them over and over again so the listener can never quite get comfortable with the song structure. This happens frequently on the title track, and many of the other licks on the albums are variations on that theme. Calling this progressive rock would probably not be correct. Maybe more like transgressive rock, or in some cases even regressive rock, since Neurosis, they don't hesitate to abandon the 2-4 rock beat for something more traditional, like the march that introduces the opening track to Crawl Under One's Skin. And something that really grabbed me about this album is the way that Neurosis seamlessly incorporates a wide variety of instrumentation. Oftentimes, the use of wind instruments and strings can sound pretty abrasive when they're set against distorted guitars. Souls at Zero weaves them in so subtly that you can be 3 minutes into a song before you realize that a flautist's been laying down kind of this loose counter melody in the background almost the whole time. And Trav, you'll be happy to know that our old favorites, the upright chimes, also make an appearance. It's definitely been the year of the upright chimes. But then without a doubt, my favorite track on the album is one called A Chronology for Survival. I can only describe as dark funk, since it sets syncopated vocals and this kind of squawk box distortion against a chanted incantation that sounds like it was ripped straight off the opening act of Macbeth. Overall, I'm not quite as starstruck with this one as I was with Colors from Between the Buried and Me last episode. The record Souls at Zero has some structure problems, and the particular edition that I bought just kind of peters out with these useless bonus tracks and demos and live versions that are almost totally skippable. Having said that, I can still certainly understand why this is considered one of those seminal albums I've been interested in lately. I can only imagine how dangerous this stuff must have sounded at a time when the pop culture world was still trying to wrap its head around bands like Nirvana. So if you're into atmospherics and some of metal's darker crevasses, Souls at Zero by Neurosis is definitely an album that you should check out. Trev, have you encountered this one at all, or any of Neurosis' work?
I haven't, but I'm curious. Is this is this album more along the lines of, I mean, I don't want to say concept album because that evokes the wrong things, but sort of a, is it a one of those things that you're going to have to listen to it from the beginning to end to get the full experience, or is it in that sort of older style of like a collection of tracks? Which camp does that one lie in?
It kind of straddles the fence, because there are definitely some connecting threads in that each track does have that opening kind of storm of audio samples and clips before proceeding into the song. But when I listen to it, I find myself actually picking and choosing different tracks because some are definitely stronger than others. So it's not a cohesive concept in that you need to, you know, throw on your headphones and commit yourself to the you know, full hour or however long it may be. It kind of has that old traditional feel of a just an album, a collection of songs. So I think it kind of leans more in that direction.
All right, cool. That will wrap things up for the Mr. Hones Opuses segment of the show. When we come back, we're going to have our full-length review of The Imposter. So we'll see you there. And we're back to The Real House with Deej and Trav. We are about to jump into our review of the new film, The Imposter, which has just been released on video on demand. So it's pretty easily accessible. I got it through Amazon. I don't know about you, Deej. But before we get into the review, I should say this is kind of one of those movies that I would say is more enjoyable the less you know about it. So I would just say that I would recommend seeing this movie. If you don't want to hear our review, then I'm not going to hold it against you, but just promise me you'll listen to it after you see the movie. All right, we got that deal going on. Okay. DJ, would you agree in that you'd recommend this thing?
Yeah, certainly, and I can actually offer a differing perspective. I knew everything about this movie,
oh, wow.
even the final twist before going in, and I would still recommend it.
All right. DJ, that's interesting. I didn't know that, because I knew nothing about this movie going in. What was the experience like knowing about this movie? And maybe you want to just give a plot summary for those who have listened who don't even think they're going to watch the movie anyway.
Yeah, I was a little bit concerned going in, since I had kind of spoiled this movie for myself beforehand, that I would not enjoy the experience as much as if I had gone in cold. But this is one of those movies where the spoilers are spoilers for real life, right? So
yeah.
This documentary, The Imposter, tells the tale of a guy named Friedrich Bourdin, who claims to be the long-lost son of this family, the Barclays, from San Antonio, Texas. So I believe it's in the 90s, correct me if I'm wrong, Trav, or maybe this kid, Nicholas Barclay from San Antonio, Texas, goes missing, I think, in the late 80s when he's about 13 years old, or maybe it's early 90s, whatever. And then 3 years later, so basically after everyone's given up and kind of assumed that this kid is just dead somewhere and not able to be found, this family, the Barclays in San Antonio, gets a phone call from Spain saying that they have found Nicholas Barclay. They need to send someone over there to Spain right now to verify his identity and bring him home. Well, it turns out that this supposed Nicholas Barclay is this imposter named Frederick Bourdin, and he's assumed the identity of this missing kid so that he can move to the United States and kind of build a new life there. So that's the basic idea of this documentary, and it explores kind of all the different facets of what's involved there. So allow me to pull a quote at this point from Michael Caine's character Cutter in The Prestige, when he's describing the nature of illusion. He says, "Now you're looking for the secret, but you won't find it, of course, because you're not really looking. You don't really want to work it out. You want to be fooled." So illusions are never...
I think you mean you want to be food.
Yeah, I wasn't going to try the Michael Caine accent. The Michael Caine accent.
You want to be food.
So illusions are never just built by one person, right? It's this communal act between the illusionist and his audience. That, I think, is the idea at the core of this documentary, The Imposter. Friedrich Bourdin, this imposter, he is an illusionist, but he's a kind of illusionist that society is far less ready to accept than, say, Siegfried and Roy. He is a con artist, and this movie is about his art form, the art of crafting an illusion to exploit people by engineering perception and by manipulating media and manipulating people. Now, Trav, when we reviewed that documentary, Resurrect Dead, about the Toynbee tiles a few episodes back, we talked about the idea of what makes a documentary successful. Is it just the subject of the documentary itself, or does the documentarian have some kind of obligation to elevate the material in some way? Well, The Imposter is a perfect example of a documentary that succeeds in all of its capacities and in all of its obligations. Director Bart Layton weaves and blends reality in some really inventive ways that draw these flawless parallels to Bourdin's own deception within the story. The boldest example is the reenactments in themselves, which feature look-alike stand-ins, these actors who lip-sync along with the audio that's recorded during the interviews with the actual subjects. And the way that Layton cuts back and forth between the talking head segments and the reenactments, using voiceovers and using transitions, really keeps the whole thing fluid and alive. He also fools around with live editing techniques, like in Haneke's Funny Games. Like, portions of the documentary will kind of rewind themselves and play themselves back over, and it's like almost kind of a found footage thing. And also incorporation of film clips to build certain parts of the narrative. And then he also, it also doesn't hurt that that narrative is itself endlessly fascinating. The documentary presents the story almost as a tale of two cities, right? There's the dark, perpetually rainy world of, I think the city's called Liberness in Spain, and then the dry, sun-bleached isolation of San Antonio in Texas, where this guy ends up. And that dichotomy puts the viewer on some really shaky ground, because you can almost sympathize with Bourdin's desire to escape his past in Europe and claim a new identity for himself, while at the same time revealing that there may be more than meets the eye to this bereaved family in Texas, which gets back to the whole illusion thing. The Barclay family wants to be fooled, maybe in more ways than one, and Bourdin just happens to show up at just the right time to help them pull the wool over their own eyes. This film is endlessly fascinating and incredibly tense, revealing in many ways that truth is indeed stranger than fiction. Like, take the private investigator who shows up in the kind of the final third of the movie. He feels like he came straight out of an Elmore Leonard novel. I mean, his name is Charlie Parker, for crying out loud. And the fact that he is the only one to see through the illusion, while all these family members and government officials have been duped, It's classic detective novel stuff, and it's simply amazing. And that was something I just found totally hilarious about this movie, listening to these bureaucrats and these government officials trying to make excuses for their colossal screw-up in letting this imposter through immigration services. And then if things weren't already crazy enough, the story does take another turn near the end. And the audience
say that
is,
this, if you're going to get into it, we should just say that this whole thing is the spoiler section.
Yeah, that's probably the best way to do it. Yeah. Because once the twist happens, the audience, you're left with no ground to stand on, more or less. It's kind of like when J.K. Simmons just turns up his hands at the end of Burn After Reading and says, "So what have we learned?" I absolutely loved this movie. It's certainly one of, if not the best movie of the year. So I was totally floored by this thing. Even knowing all of its little twists and turns, it still totally mesmerized me, and my mind is still kind of reeling from all the implications, just the fact that this is an actual story that happened and kind of what that means for our interactions with our fellow human beings. So Trav, I'm curious to hear what your thoughts on this movie are.
Yeah, I loved it just as much as you did, and yeah, that interaction between the con artist and the victim as sort of this dialogue is definitely what is at the center of this movie, and when the rug is pulled underneath you with the twist at the end, it kind of leaves you wondering who's on which side of that dialogue and whether or not you've or if you're being double duped and that there was no real twist at all from the beginning. I guess we might have a later in the review, I guess we'll talk about that explicitly, but I just want to touch on some little detail stuff that you didn't touch on, Deej, because I agree with pretty much everything you said, and I don't want to reiterate. There's a lot of really awesome editing in this movie. When characters will be talking about other characters, that's when these people will be talking about other people in these interviews, they will cut to that person that's being talked about just looking at the camera or at the interviewer or just off into space, and it's this, and then sometimes the interviewee will stop talking and will stay on the person about whom they were speaking, just kind of lingering there and, you know, unable to know, you know, what they would say in response or what they're thinking. There's just kind of this, kind of that, I think of that shot of Citizen Kane where it starts and it's just, there's just that no trespassing sign, you know, like we're not going to be able to reach that boundary through that sort of mental space into their mind and figure out what's going on. We can't trespass into their thoughts as much as we would want to, and the editing really brings that desire out in you. And there's a lot of also really good work on the sound design of this movie. One of the really cool effects that they do a lot is when a person is supposed to be talking on the phone, you'll see them being interviewed and you'll see them speaking, but they'll be speaking with a filter that makes it sound like they're speaking on the phone, which adds a sort of confusing layer of, wait, am I watching the reenactment still, or is this part of the, and it adds to that effect where, that you mentioned, where these reenactments, you almost forget that they're reenactments and you just feel like you're just a fly on the wall watching these happen, and that sort of subtle, well, that one isn't necessarily subtle, but there are more subtle things that go on with the sound that allow that transition to be seamless and to keep you convinced the whole time. But I think the real star of the show here is just Frederick Bourdon's facial expressions. There'll be a lot of times where he'll just kind of, his head will kind of sink to the lower part of the frame, and he'll just kind of look up at you like, with this sort of knowing glance that, like, yeah, I've got you fooled, or I know I'm impressing you right now, or just like sort of this you can't outsmart me feel, especially with that twist at the end, and there's just this sort of enigma surrounding not even an enigma. There's just this sort of, you're just so impressed at what he does. And then when that twist comes, you don't know if you should not be as impressed anymore, or if you should be even more impressed, by his ability to con you as the audience and also all the people around him during his time pretending to be Nicholas. DJ, do you want to just start talking about that twist at the end so you don't have to tiptoe around it, or do you want to respond to anything I said in that bit first?
No, I think we can jump right into it, because, yeah, I'm totally in agreement with you. This movie is amazing, and it's just the nature of his character as a person, this idea of Frederick Bourdain, is just totally hypnotic. The way he kind of pulls you in and almost kind of draws you onto his side, you're almost rooting for him at certain points in the movie. So it's just kind of a testament to it feels like a stretch to call it his skills, because it's so devious what he's doing, but it's still really quite remarkable. So as I mentioned earlier, documentaries tend to suggest things. The documentarian maybe has an agenda he's trying to get across. And at a certain point in this movie, the film strongly suggests that the Barclay family killed Nicholas Barclay, that certain members of the Barclay family may be responsible for the disappearance and death of Nicholas Barclay. Because according to Frederick Bourdain's theory, the Barclay family was far too willing to accept his con, his illusion, to the point where he claims the sister was actually kind of giving him a script to follow to fool the immigration officers into playing the role of into satisfying the role of Nicholas Barclay. The idea being that if Frederick could fill this role of Nicholas Barclay, it would kind of alleviate any lingering doubt about where this child went, because perhaps they did actually kill him. Now, the movie ends up suggesting that strongly, not only because Frederick Bourdain claims to believe it, but because some of these, I think it's that FBI agent in particular seems to believe it, the private investigator seems to believe that the Barclays killed Nicholas. And so right up to the end, you're kind of convinced that the Barclay family is hiding something. But then the kind of closing shots of this movie are just an exploration of Frederick Bourdain's other cons. It's briefly mentioned all these different other identities he's assumed, and it's kind of presented to you in this barrage. It's something like 50 different identities that he's assumed over the years, and it talks about how he'll call government agencies and law enforcement agencies claiming to have information on disappearances and kidnappings, but it's all lies. He's a pathological liar. So, like I said, the movie leaves you with no ground to stand on, because you have this theory of the disappearance of this child and what caused that disappearance, and then it's being presented to you by someone who lies professionally. And he's even convinced these people, like I mentioned, the FBI agent, the private investigator, a lot of other people, into believing that theory. And so we feel as the audience that we're turned against the Barclay family, but then at the end, in revealing his true nature, it just throws the whole thing into a mess, and I really don't know what to think of it, to be honest with you. I think my main read of the movie, or I guess my opinion on the situation, is that the Barclays probably know something more about Nicholas's disappearance that they're leading on to. Whether or not they actually killed him, I think, is something we may never know. So, well, what are your thoughts, Trev?
Well, the problem is that the movie wants to lead you into an opinion about this just from seeing the movie. I hadn't heard anything about this story, and, you know, at that point where, you know, before there's sort of that doubt again at the end, when you're sort of convinced that this Barclay family murdered Nicholas Barclay, the movie, like, compels you to think that, even though all you've seen is this movie talk about it, which is normally way not, like, normally we wouldn't have nearly that concrete of an opinion from just watching one perspective on it. But the movie, just like Frederick Bourdon, is sly enough to force an opinion on you, depending on which side it is. And at the end of the movie, it reminds you, sort of, hey, Frederick Bourdon is a compulsive liar. Why would you trust him? And then you kind of go, oh, yeah, so you're lost there. But then the final shot of the movie is someone digging in a spot where they think Nicholas' body is, and which is in the back of the old house that the Barclays lived. And if it were there, it would sort of prove that the Barclays killed him. But then the movie cuts and ends, and it sort of reminds you as the audience, oh, yeah, this has just been a movie the whole time. I mean, sure, it's a documentary, but it reminds you that this is not all that there is. There's sort of a dramatic arc to this thing you've been watching, and so you, by the end of the movie, you can't even trust the movie's narrative, let alone the narrative of any of these people. And so I think that's one of the movie's biggest strengths, is that you're so without grounding by the end of it that you almost can't. I don't know. You know, I was almost convinced to have an opinion, but then I realized that I definitely should not have one. And that just attests to the strength of the movie. And you know, when they inject that sort of doubt that, you know, why should you be listening to this Frederick Bourdon, it'll always cut to him, and he'll do those expressions that I mentioned earlier, and it's so slimy and disgusting. But then you'll see the Barclay family, and they do look like they might be hiding something. So the movie is very good at just shifting your position from whatever it wants to. You're completely in the palm of its hand for the whole thing, and I think that's what makes it spectacular.
Yeah, that final shot is a masterstroke. It's kind of alliterization of that old mantra that, you know, you go digging up the past and all you get is dirty, right? These two guys digging in that hole, we know they're not going to find anything down there, but it's just kind of an exploration of everything that the movie is. They're, you know, bad things have happened in the past and we're probably never going to find answers to them, and by digging for them, we're just going to uncover other nasty things.
Yeah. I don't really have much more to say other than, if you haven't been convinced to watch this movie, I don't know what's wrong with you. You definitely should. Nisha, do you want to say anything before I wrap up the show?
Yeah, I guess I remember for me, there was a time when I was just totally predisposed against documentaries for some reason. I was like, oh, I want to have the experience of, you know, interpreting fiction or something like that. I don't want to just be told the way something is. But it's gotten to the point where I think documentaries are probably account for the most interesting movies that I see every year, because it is not that way. It's not, documentaries never tell you how something is. If anything, they obfuscate to even a greater degree, and just trying to parse through all that is incredibly fascinating and thought-provoking. So if you're kind of in that spot that I was, where you feel predisposed against documentaries, just get over that, and the best way to do that is probably by watching this movie, because it will blow your mind.
Yep. Mind blown. All right, well, DJ, where can I find you around the interwebs?
You can follow me on Twitter at DJ Wheeler, and then you can also follow me on This Is My Jam at DJ Wheeler. I try to post jams that are from my opus for the given week, so check that stuff out.
You can follow me at twitter.com/thetravisw and thisismyjam.com/thetravisw. If you have any questions, suggestions, comments for and about the show, you can email me at thethirdreel@gmail.com. That's thethirdreel@gmail.com. Please rate and review this show on iTunes. The fifth star is the one that I enjoy the most. If you write a review, it allows us to be more visible in the iTunes store. That's kind of how their algorithms work. But I guess, as always, the ears don't match.
Mine was, as always, when I got back to the office, I put the photos into Adobe Photoshop. Mutiny's been electrocuted!